Air travel during a pandemic. Biscayne Bay gets a protector and a fight over an illegal lake. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. There were a lot more people traveling this past holiday season than in previous months, but traffic through Miami International Airport is still way below expected numbers.
The problem from our observation is when people are arriving at their destination, they're letting their guard down.
Is it safe to travel by air? Also, Irela Begay is now in charge of fixing and protecting Biscayne Bay. We'll discuss her strategy for taking on developers and pollution. And finally, a group of developers in Boynton Beach are building a lake without permits, and no one is stopping them. Will that set a dangerous precedent? All of that today on Sundial. First the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for listening today. Well, more than 3.5 million people across the United States crossed security checkpoints over the course of the winter holidays. That brought air travel a needed boost, as it's one of the industries hardest hit by the pandemic. The numbers, though, are still nowhere near where they were pre-COVID. Now, one of the biggest questions remains whether travel can be done without spreading the virus. Earlier this week, the U.S. announced beginning January 26, all international travelers must present a negative COVID test before entering the U.S. We spoke yesterday with Lester Sola, director of Miami International Airport, about the new ruling and about keeping passengers safe on the ground and in the air.
If you're going to be traveling abroad, if you're a U.S. citizen or you're someone international and you're coming to the U.S., just like some countries are requiring today, you would be required to get a test, a COVID test. Now, there's two types of COVID tests, and both of those tests are being accepted. So depending on the country that you're at, as long as you can get a COVID test that shows that you're negative 72 hours before travel, you will be allowed to board the plane and enter the U.S.
How are you going to confirm that those tests are legitimate?
So just like today, if you are traveling internationally to the U.S., when you're booking your flight, all that information is being processed by both the federal government and the airlines. When you show up to a ticket counter today and your passport is scanned at the airline, that information is being fed to national databases. And if there's a check and balance, making sure that you are in fact authorized to enter the U.S., and that same protocol will be handled with regards to the tests that are being provided by the travelers to the airlines. The airlines have a certain level of responsibility to ensure that the individual that's before them and the test that they're providing is in fact a valid test.
Can you trust all of those tests coming from? I mean, there are countries we don't feel have credibility with us.
Well, there's actually in the regulation that's been issued, there's also an opportunity for a country that does not have the means, or the airports or the airlines that have the means to provide testing in that particular country, there's a process by which that country can request an exception. No exceptions have been issued at this time, but I will tell you that the airlines and the conversations that we've been having, they're very much involved in trying to reestablish air travel. So the airlines themselves are looking to establish some type of testing protocol within the airports of those countries that they do not feel confident that they'll be able to ramp up the testing to the level that they will have to be. So we are all stakeholders here in Miami-Dade County. We are not doing testing at the airport because we do not want people thinking that they're not feeling well or coming to get a test at the airport within the environment of the thousands and thousands of people that are going through the airport. And the county has many testing sites throughout the community that can give you results within a day's time frame, if not less so. But not every county has the capability to do that. And the airlines are adapting by providing their own tests.
So a lot more airplanes are flying over my house than I remember. I remember at one point I barely ever heard one. Now I'm hearing them regularly. So does that mean that we are starting to see the industry coming back? Are we looking at numbers anywhere close to what they were pre-pandemic?
So we're close to, on an average day, we're between 40 to 50% of the travel that we were for a similar year. So 2019 was a record year for us, so having 46 million passengers going through the airport in a year. a million more than the previous year in 2018. So we were growing by a million passengers year after year. 2020, obviously, we started off great, the Super Bowl and several other events. And then in March, when the pandemic hit, on an average day, we would do about 100,000 to 110,000 passengers a day. That equates to about 1,000 flights a day. Now, and in March, we actually had 3,500 passengers. Now, we've come a long way. Today, we're averaging anywhere between 50 to 90,000 passengers. So we're certainly in a recovery path, if you will, but we're still not where we need to be in order to have a similar year that we've had in 2019.
Now, I read that the holiday travel was up, but it didn't meet expectations. It wasn't as good as the airlines had hoped. What did we see over the holidays?
Definitely more than what we had expected, but clearly not what we were used to in the prior years. But it was our busiest time of the year post-pandemic. We basically did 1.2 million passengers during the 17-day winter holiday period, which is from Monday, December 21st through Wednesday, January 6th. Now, those numbers have come back down to our averages during the pandemic.
You know, thinking about the holiday travel, I did a little bit of traveling. I know one of our producers during Thanksgiving was at MIA. She said that, you know, walking around the airport, she saw that it was packed. It looked packed, but she saw that very few people were observing the social distancing or using their masks properly. Tell me a little bit about enforcement. Is there enforcement right now? I mean, I can tell you, I saw the same thing, and I don't know, can you enforce it?
Very, very much so. Enforcement is very, very big for us. And I'm surprised about the comment about the mask. I will tell you that we have an entire operations. Everyone in the terminal is basically geared towards making sure that if someone isn't wearing a mask, that they be informed that they have to wear a mask. And if they don't have a mask, they're provided a mask. So we do extremely well with the mask. Now, social distancing can be difficult when people are traveling in groups. It's hard to determine who is part of a family unit and not part of a family unit. So we do try and notify them either through visual or audio messages, as well as the airline personnel and the airport personnel. But that does become a much larger challenge to maintain through such a large operation. But we do provide shields as far as the plexiglass. There are social distancing masks laid out throughout the entire terminal, as well as through security. So we've taken a very active role in not just in enforcement, but also educating the passengers. But it is, in fact, a challenging operation at times.
I've read about people who've been thrown off airplanes, but have you thrown anybody out of an airport?
So we have not thrown people out of the airport. And in fact, when we bring them to their awareness that they need to wear a mask or that they have to wear the mask properly, people comply. The issue is, you know, whether we're going to make sure that people understand, right, through the education, that it's not just that you have to wear your mask when you're on the plane. It's your entire journey when you're going through the airport, when you're going through the check-in, when you're going through security, and ultimately on the plane. I will tell you that we meet with the airlines on a regular basis, and the airlines know that the only way that they can continue to recover is through not just through education and providing the mask when people don't have one, but through enforcement. In order for the industry to recover, it's going to require that people conform to the mandate.
You know, I mean, I'm trying to think about when I first noticed it. I think going back to September, I took a trip and the plane was packed. And I asked somebody, wait a minute, I thought they were spacing us out. I guess the airlines gave up on that, the idea of putting a seat in between us.
It's very difficult. And a lot of the flight itself, nowadays, really, the transmission possibility within an airplane is very small, because not just because of the mandate and the requirements that you have to wear a mask, but also the filtration systems that are being used in today's airplanes are significantly, significantly different and much more aggressive and progressive than they were in the past, right? So the amount of air that is being refreshed, that new air coming from the outside into the cabin, is happening every few minutes. And in addition to that, the airplane air is actually being processed through HEPA filters, the same kind of filters that are being used in operating rooms. So the airline industry feels very confident that the air within the airplane is clean.
Well, are you confident? Because, I mean, look, I'm not a doctor, but at the same time, okay, they have good, you know, filtration systems, but You know how packed airplanes get. That person sitting not even 6 inches from me. We're touching each other. You know, do you feel safe?
Very much so. And I will tell you that the issue here really is not just the flight duration, right? The majority of the flights that are taking place in this country right now are domestic travel. And those, for the most part, tend to be short unless you're going to the West Coast, right? So the problem that we're seeing is that when people are taking care of themselves when they're going through the journey of travel, right? The problem is that people are not conforming to the norms and to the requirements of social distancing and wearing masks when they're amongst family and friends. So yes, are they within close proximity in an airplane? Yes, we recognize that, but they're also being mandated that they have to wear a mask. So at least they're taking measures that are being enforced within the plane. The problem from our observation is when people are arriving at their destinations, they're letting their guard down.
I'm speaking with the director of Miami International Airport, Lester Sola. Beginning January 26, all international travelers coming to the United States must show a negative COVID test. You can find more about airline travel during COVID by going to WLRN.org. Like any airport, I mean, you depend on passengers, but you also depend on cargo for business. And right now, domestic travel is going up slightly, but international travel, which my MIA also depends a lot on, is still slow. What are we seeing right now when it comes to domestic to international, and how's the cargo business?
No secret that we're the gateways to the Americas, so the majority of our international travelers are from South America, Central America, and the Caribbean. In addition to that, we do get significant volume of international travel from the European market. So those markets have suffered significantly during the pandemic, right? So on a day like today, we'll do 70% domestic travel and 30% international travel. So we believe that with the requirement of PCR testing or other types of COVID testing prior to coming into the U.S., that would allow for some of these markets that have been closed for several months now to open up with the utilization and the requirement of COVID testing. Now, as far as cargo really has been something that has not been impacted whatsoever, and in fact has grown during the pandemic. The airport historically has always grown cargo year over year. We're a unique airport that we have a significant cargo operation. And oftentimes people don't understand, and it's hard for them to realize that the flights into South America, into the Caribbean, into Europe are not just full of individuals and luggage, but also cargo. So whether we're pushing cargo through electronics, computers into the South American market and the Caribbean market, they're coming back with perishable food, right? So it's important for the airline industry, not just in the movement of people, but also with cargo operations. And more so during the pandemic, this airport, the fact that we're certified as a pharma hub, we're certified to be able to move pharmaceutical products, whether it be medicines, vaccines, as we're seeing, as well as PPEs, which were so important during the early portion of the pandemic.
You mentioned vaccines, and I wanted to ask you about vaccine, cargo, and how much are we seeing coming in? Where is it coming from?
So I do not know how many, but we have been in coordination with the airlines, the federal government, and the pharmaceutical companies in the movement of vaccines. So those vaccines would be part of regular shipments, either through Federal Express, UPS, DHL, and other carriers into the South American market.
The other thing too is this: obviously, MIA has a big impact on county finances, and look, the cities are going to be hurting because of this pandemic. But how big a chunk of that is coming from the fact that MIA business is not as big as it usually is?
So we are the number one economic engine in this community. So just to throw out some numbers, on any day you have 30,000 people working at this airport, from all the way from the airlines to county employees, rental agencies. So it just within the footprint of the airport, a very sizable employment operation in the community, so whether it be the hotels, the service industry, you're looking in the neighborhoods of 300,000 to 400,000 jobs that are associated with the activities that take place through the airport. But we recognize that it's not just leisure travel. It's people who have second homes here, people who are running their businesses, who have other businesses here. So what we have done is recognizing that we play such an important role and we have a very sizable capital program, and knowing that air travel will be back, we've moved on some of our capital projects to create jobs, right? More construction jobs, so that as the expansion of this airport, not just for the future, we can take advantage of the downtime now of some of the areas that would have been more disruptive doing it during the higher volumes of air travel. If we can do it now, we can create jobs and also have a less of an impact to the operations of the airport.
I wanted to ask you about your view of the future, because here we are still vaccinating. We're only in the early phases of vaccination. And, you know, now I'm reading that, you know, some of these vaccinations may only last a year or two. We may have to get booster shots on a regular basis. So it just brings up the question, do we ever go back to normal? What do you see happening the rest of this year?
So I think that we will recover. And I'll give you the way I describe it is this. When testing was rolling out, it was very difficult and long lines to get a test. Now you can pretty much go anywhere in this county and get a test. The next morning you'll have the results, right? So we evolve. We're able to adjust and be able to deliver on the services. There is a lot of pent up demand for air travel, and we see that within the reservations of airlines and the travel industry. The vaccine. And there's obviously much that is unknown, but people feel comfortable. If we're able to get the vaccine administered, we believe that air travel will come back. Now, a significant portion of the operation that we see that will come back quickly is the leisure travel and those individuals that either have a home and are used to coming into this area. We think that is a certainty. We have very little doubt that part of the population that travels will come back. The business travel will go through some adjustments with the online platforms and being able to people working tele-remotely. I think that has pushed the industry forward to that. But there is nothing compared to the one-on-one interaction. And we believe that once the vaccine is rolled out and people feel comfortable with that vaccine, and regardless of whether you're going to require a booster or not, it's much unknown at this point, people will feel safe. And if people will feel safe, they'll be safe interacting with others.
In the coming week, a transfer of power and new administration coming in. Have there been talks of perhaps another stimulus package, this for the airlines, perhaps a bailout? Have you heard anything about that?
So the airport did receive significant finance assistance from the federal government, just like all the other airports did. There's a smaller package that was recently approved. There's talk of additional packages in the future. It is hard to tell, and it's going to depend on the impact on the vaccine and on the recovery. And I think that's going to measure as to what kind of assistance, if any, the airlines and the airports receive. So for us, while we did receive some federal monies, it's important to note that there's no monies from county taxpayers coming into the airport. In fact, we generate money into the economy and into taxpayers rather than the other way around. The airport has significant cash reserves to have weathered and to continue to weather this situation. So we're in very good financial health, and we take that very seriously, to not just for now, but making sure that our financial health is stable and secure for the long term.
That was the director of Miami International Airport, Lester Sola. You can find more about traveling during COVID-19. Just go to our social media at WLRN Sundial. Well, still to come, Biscayne Bay is suffering from pollution and fish die-offs. Can it be saved? Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Water is such an essential part of our identity in South Florida. And for those living in Miami-Dade, Biscayne Bay is a treasured resource for boaters, beachgoers, and anglers. It's an essential part of the region's economy. The bay has suffered from chronic pollution and algae blooms and seagrass die-offs. This past summer, a major fish die-off drew headlines. The marine life ecosystem is facing grave threats, including the coral reefs. Now, the county recently created a new position charged with protecting this essential resource, Chief Bay Officer. And the first person given that title and responsibility is Irela Begay. She begins now this new position, and she joins us to tell us more about it. Irela, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me, Luis. How are you?
I'm doing great. I mean, first of all, congratulations, but let's understand what this position will represent. And I wanted to start with this, your take on what makes Biscayne Bay so different from other bays and estuaries around the country.
Well, primarily because of its size. It pretty much covers from the north end of our county all the way to the Florida Keys. It's a vast watershed. So it, you know, covers a number of local coastal cities, and obviously our county government is responsible for most of it, but there are so many other jurisdictions. For example, the Florida Department of Environmental Protection, the South Florida Water Management District, the Aquatic Preserve. So there's a number of, you know, different agencies and local governments involved in and around the bay.
I mentioned some of the problems, the big mm-hmm. ones, but how do you describe when people ask what's happening to the bay right now?
Everything's happening to the bay. And when I say everything, it's the I'm talking about pollution. Mm-hmm. So everything that we do on the land ends up in the bay. And that's the message that I try to give the general public and everyone else, obviously, and decision makers, because it's a number of issues. There's not one direct, source. It's a number of sources. So we have to attack them systematically, right? And that's why back in 2019, the county commission with the leadership of Commissioner Rebecca Sosa decided to put together this Biscayne Bay Task Force, which of course, you know, I chaired. And it took us 18 months to really drill down on really what was going on. And that's basically what we realized. We also realized that, again, I mentioned all the different jurisdictions and different agencies and governments involved, but there was no one really coordinating any of these issues and any of these agencies and any of these projects that were being implemented, because some things are being done to help the bay, but nothing's being done in a coordinated, holistic fashion.
Yeah, I mean, you talk about, look, the efforts to protect the bay is not new. It's been around a while. I mean, you go back to when
1971.
It's for a long time, there have been efforts to fix problems and to preserve the water. So why hasn't any of that worked?
You know, I think, some things have worked and some things were implemented, but every time the bay gets back to normal, you know, people go on to other things. And so there really hasn't been an oversight or a watchdog really on a consistent basis, right? So that's what's been missing. And I, you know, during the task force meetings, I would always reference, I chaired the Miami River Commission, which exists to, you know, really to provide oversight over a canal that feeds into Biscayne Bay. How is that possible that we have more oversight over the Miami River than we do for the Biscayne Bay watershed? And it's probably because it's so vast. But at the end of the day, we've run out of time. So there's no more time to put together another report.
Let me come back to something you said, though, a second ago, is that because we talk about all the efforts to protect the bay, and you said, well, some things have worked. Like what?
Well, like creating the aquatic preserve, for example. Other things have worked for, you know, I mean, we created DERM back in the 70s to really, you know, look at regulating and also protecting the pollution and, you know, the development and the planning. The problem is that we've grown so much that we're now having to, you know, deal with the consequences of that growth. More people, more pollution, more problems.
And then of course, one of the other challenges too, is that it seems like things have gotten worse. You know, really, when you think about it. And Miami-Dade County says more than 20 square miles of seagrass have died off since 2012. And along with that, we had the fish kill. So when you look at that, really right off the bat, what do you think is the solution, or how do you tackle it? How are you going to tackle that?
Well, I'll tell you, first of all, the Chief Bay Officer stemmed from the development of a governance structure that the task force recommended the county set up. And that's one of the, you know, main goals that I plan to initiate immediately. You know, the Chief Bay Officer will serve as an advisor, an advocate, and a coordinator. That's the way I look at the job. And I took the job primarily because I wanted to see these recommendations move forward, and so that this report does not sit on a shelf like what's happened in the past. So that's, you know, my number one priority is to assemble this watershed management board and the committees that go along with it. And that's me. That means bringing in all the agencies, all the cities, all the stakeholder groups that we heard from loud and clear when we were initiating our task force.
So you've got all these groups, you've got all of these different, you know, communities that are involved. And again, as you said, we're growing, so that adds to the problem, but then add to that, because I want to add more to your plate, warmer water, sea rise, climate change. how do you tackle that?
Well, we tackle that. You know, the good news is that a lot of work has been done, as you know, with the Southeast Florida Climate Compact, as well as the 305 Resilient Plan that we plan to, I think there's an update coming up tomorrow, actually, on that report. And that's brought everyone to the table on sea level rise issues. Sea level rise issues are complementary with some of the issues that we're seeing with septic to sewer. And this is why septic to sewer conversions in low-lying areas are critical to be, you know, to engage in immediately, so that we can prevent these systems from failing, which will impact the Bay even more. So there's a definitely correlation between that. Obviously, the fish kill, warmer waters, more pollution, the algae grows, it, you know, chokes up all this oxygen, and you have what we had over the summer. That's what we need to prevent. And as you know, the NOAA report that came out, the grand jury report that came out a few years ago, basically said, listen, we're at a tipping point. So, but the scientists tell me that there is time, and this is why we need to act now and act together.
Again, I'm talking with Irela Bagay. She's recently appointed as Miami-Dade's first Chief Bay Officer, basically in charge of looking over, protecting, and trying to fix the problems in Biscayne Bay. And she's charged with preserving that bay, again, through creating policy and some of the other things that you've heard her just say. You can find us on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial. You can email us, sundial@wlrnnews.org, if you have a question for her, or just your thoughts on what are the challenges in protecting the bay. We heard from Andrew Otaza. He's a local environmentalist. He spends a lot of time cleaning out plastic from Biscayne Bay. And he had a question for you. Here it is.
My name is Andrew Otaso. I'm a local environmentalist who's removed 12,000 pounds of trash from South Florida's coastline over the last 3 years. And I want to know, what concrete policies are you going to implement to slow the rate at which South Florida's plastic products wind up in the bay?
All right, that's Andrew's question for you.
Great question. Well, I am not responsible for enacting policy. I just want to make it very clear that is up to my bosses, which are the mayor and the Board of County Commissioners. However, we've all seen how frustrating it is that, you know, we've had some cities enact some plastic bans, and the state comes in and you know, preempts local communities from doing what they want to do. That is a big challenge. However, I think the key here is public education and making the connection, having the public understand that what happens on land ends up in our waterways and in Biscayne Bay, particularly with stormwater. You know, the public really needs to understand that we are all part of the problem, and we need to also be part of the solution. So that falls into, you know, public education campaigns, and I'm not just talking about our residents, but also our visitors. You just had the airport director on before me, and, you know, we're hoping that we can engage in a multifaceted public education campaign incorporating many, many, many cleanups and partnerships with cleanup organizations. I mean, we really have to like do what we did back in the day when we started pounding people on recycling, for example.
But do you have any power to say for, you know, to push any community towards, you know, anti-plastics kind of legislation, or go to Tallahassee and say to lawmakers, we got to do more. Let's push for these kind of laws.
Well, yeah, I mean, we can do that. What we have to do is really work with the business community, right? Because oftentimes what happens is that we all, with good intentions, pass policies, but we forget to engage the stakeholders that are affected down the road. And businesses are affected, let's face it. So why don't we bring everyone to the table and come up with solutions that, you know, can be a win-win for everyone. So that's also an engagement that I hope I can bring to the table from my experience at the Greater Miami Chamber of Commerce working with the business community. So there's a lot to do. There's a lot to do, Luis.
No, you do. You have a lot on your plate, as I said. But I wanted to know why you wanted to get involved with this. As you pointed out, I mean, you chaired the Miami River Commission. But the other thing, too, is this. Why wouldn't they hire a scientist?
Well, because we have plenty of scientists in the county. We have plenty of engineers at the county. What we don't have is a communicator and a connector, which is what I've done my entire career. Since I started my career at the county, I worked for a county commissioner, and I handled district office constituent services. So that's what I've been doing all my life. And I became a passionate Biscayne Bay advocate when I served on the South Florida Water Management Governing Board. And I realized how, you know, water really has no boundaries. And we really need to take a concerted and collaborative approach around this. And I call it a one water approach. It's not my coined term. It's a term that exists. And it's really taking a holistic approach when we look at projects, for example. When we look at the hotspots, and we look at the data that we're seeing where the pollution is more concentrated, we take an approach like that and we work with, you know, across departments. We work with DERM, we work with water and sewer, we work with public work, with resilience, and partner with the local governments. And that's how I see some of these areas, some of these solutions coming into to these areas. And just, you know, like a strike team, basically.
You know, you think about, as you said, this area has grown so much. It's mm-hmm. a hot area. Everybody wants to buy here. Let's just face it. And I'm wondering, how do you deal with the challenge of facing these developers? You know, even with sea level rise, people still want to buy next to the water. And so developers, they want to keep building on the water and expanding on the water. And I'm willing to bet a lot of politicians probably aren't going to be so quick to give up that tax revenue. So how do you
well,
do
no,
that?
Of course
how do you,
not.
How do you deal with that?
That's precisely why we need to engage in a huge recovery effort for the Bay. The Bay is basically our backyard. And so who wants to buy a multi-million dollar condo when the Bay looks like, you know, you have fish kills and it looks terrible and it's slowly degrading. You know, and our beaches keep closing. And so we can't afford that. And I think the development community is realizing that. I think the tourism community has realized that. And even the cruise industry, which is now, you know, dealing with the impacts of the pandemic. So when we do come back from this pandemic, I see a lot of these projects, infrastructure projects, in collaboration with the business community, developers and others, to really, you know, join forces and promote. If we really want this to be paradise and keep paradise, then it's going to obviously cost us money to repair and recover. That's another area that I hope that, you know, I'll be able to assist with the state funding, federal funding, and even some private sector funding. Yeah. There's a lot of public-private partnerships and a lot of the infrastructure improvements we need to make. And that equals jobs, Luis. And so I'm optimistic. Well, I am optimistic.
Wait a second. You're starting to sound like a politician. You know what? let me finish with this briefly. What's the first thing that you're going to tackle?
The first thing, well, there's multiple things I'm tackling. So there's not one first thing.
Is there one really big thing you want to tackle?
I really want to bring all of our stakeholders together, really set up this governance structure. Hopefully that won't take too long, but at the same time, helping to move some of these projects that were funded by the state and in partnership with the county. And those are like low hanging fruit. Some of these projects can, you know, we can hit the ground running really quickly and start showing the public that it can be done.
And you have a lot going on as holding this new position again as Chief Bay Officer. A lot is on your shoulders. I congratulate you and I wish you the best of luck.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on.
Again, it's Irela Begay. She is Miami-Dade's first Chief Bay Officer. We'll have you back because there's a lot to talk about. Again, I appreciate the time.
So.
And again, I wanted to note just real quickly on another environmental story that Tuesday on the show, we heard from Miccosukee tribal member Betty Osceola and WLRN environmental reporter Jenny Stiletovich about the EPA handing over control of wetlands permitting to Florida. Well, Osceola says that the EPA and Florida fast-tracked the approval to get it done before the Trump administration leaves. Stiletovich tells us today, seven environmental groups filed a federal lawsuit asking a judge to issue an injunction to stop the state from issuing permits. They say the state does not have the resources to manage wetlands permitting, and will continue to update you on that story. Well, still to come, there's a controversy in Boynton Beach over a lake. Could it be setting a dangerous precedent for developers?
Chasing bright stars, shining in a dark sky.
Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, west of Boynton Beach, there's a controversy brewing between a group of developers and residents of the area called Valencia Reserve. A partnership of three people are building a lake. Here's the thing. They don't have a permit to do it. And residents are angry that local leaders aren't doing enough to stop it. Now, what's the lake for? Originally, it was believed that it was going to be for water skiing, but the developers now claim it's for something else. By the way, the three developers, former water skiing competitors. Well, joining us now is Beth Rappaport. She's the president of the Coalition of Boynton West Residential Associations. Beth, thank you so much for the time.
Thank you so much for having me today. I'm so happy to be here.
Thank you. And hopefully we can, you know, get kind of an understanding of what's going on here with the story. By the way, I just want to note, we invited Palm Beach County Commissioner Maria Sachs to join us. She was unavailable. She plans to join us in the future. We did reach out to the three developers and we haven't heard back. But you know what? Let me start with this, Beth. Let me understand, who are these people in this partnership? As I mentioned, we know they are water skiers.
Yes, they are. They are water skiers. They do have a background in the water skiing industry, and that does seem to be their, their hobby or their career.
Have you talked to any of them? Have they ever spoken to any of the people in the community?
No, I have not spoken to them. I have seen them when I went out to view the site from the Valencia Reserve property, so we could see them from across the way, but we have not spoken to them.
All right, help us understand this area. I believe it's near 441, right? What there's a lake, what's in the area? Tell me, describe it to me.
Yeah, so the area is 441 and Boynton Beach Boulevard. It's a pretty well-traveled section of Boynton Beach. It's near, Bedner's Farm. There's a lot of farming around. There are some residential communities. Lyons Road is on the other side of it. And, it's just a very beautiful part of Palm Beach County.
And how many, communities are nearby? Houses or condos are nearby?
Well, COBRA represents 112 residential associations and 125,000 people. But in the immediate area, there are several thousand homes, including Valencia Reserve, Canyon Lakes, Isle Springs and Trails, and a number of other communities whose residents were attracted to the area due to its natural beauty.
And so I understand this lake that they're building is right there, right next to these homes, right? I mean, it's literally next to the properties.
Yes, it kind of wraps around Valencia Reserve, and so it borders Valencia Reserve on two sides.
Okay. Now, again, what they were building the lake for. There was original intent. Now, from my understanding of what we've seen, is that the developers want to build this stocked lake with all types of fish. They've sent the application and submitted to the state. Why is the agricultural usage for the lake critical to the legality here?
This parcel of land is in the Ag Reserve, which is, you know, a very special protected area that taxpayers voted to preserve in 1998. And it's very sensitive what happens in the Ag Reserve. And we have had, you know, there are homes in the Ag Reserve, but those developers that have built those homes have worked in very close collaboration with Palm Beach County to make sure that all the special requirements of the Ag Reserve are being followed and adhered to.
So I'm trying to understand, how is it possible to have such a massive project without the right permits? What have you heard from city and county officials? By the way, it's in unincorporated Palm Beach County, but what have you heard from officials about why this has been allowed to go forward?
The county officials have been great, and they have been very responsive. They have sent numerous groups of people out. They have spent a lot of time researching this. Their legal team has spent a lot of time on this. And the county has responded to these things by the book. And the book is designed for people that are compliant. So they might receive a violation or a stop work order and they comply. Unfortunately, this group and these developers are just non-compliant. They have not adhered by any stop work orders, nothing. And so,
something interesting is the sheriff has gone out, police have gone out, law enforcement, I don't know which ones, but law enforcement's gone out with stop work orders, and yet they continue. Now, my understanding is there's a no trespass sign, so police couldn't get into the property, but they did put the stop work order notice there on the front. I'm trying to understand, how is it possible if you have a stop work order that nobody has tried to stop them from doing anything?
Yeah, it's been very hard, and everybody is so frustrated by this because the standard procedures that are in place that would stop just about anybody else have just not stopped this group. And it's really a mystery. I think everybody just has lots of questions about this and why this is happening the way that it's happening.
When did, Beth, when did you start hearing complaints from residents, and what were those complaints?
I started hearing about it in June. An individual homeowner who lives in the immediate area, not in an HOA, but on a 5-acre parcel by the name of Scott Turtle, reached out to COBRA and wanted to let us know that there was some significant construction going on that really seemed abnormal. And he invited us to come out to his property and from his property view what was happening. And when we went out there in June, we were absolutely speechless. We could not believe what we were seeing, which is that, you know, 100 acres or so had just been completely cleared. And at the time, back in June, you couldn't really see anything from Boynton Beach Boulevard or 441. Now you can, because even more work has been done. But at the time, it was pretty well hidden, and not too many people really noticed it or knew about it.
And again, there are pictures now of what that lake looks like, what they've been building, so you could see the size and the scope of it. Again, I'm talking with Beth Rappaport, president of COBRA. We are discussing the fight over an illegal lake that's being developed west of Boynton in unincorporated Palm Beach County. You can find more information of this story on our social media at WLRN Sundial. The developers are Douglas DeBrun, Chet Raley, and Darren Montgomery. They've been invited on the program. We're awaiting their response. We'd love to hear their side of the story. And again, we will hear from the county at some point soon. By the way, if you happen to live in the area, you know, share with us what you've seen, what's going on, what you've witnessed. You can find us on Facebook or Twitter at WLRN Sundial. Email us, sundial@wlrnnews.org. I'd love to hear from you. Beth, you receive complaints about new developments, probably a lot, and it's your job to advocate for the residents. But how does this experience differ from what you've seen at any point in the past, or have you ever seen anything like this?
Typically, when a developer is launching a new project in the Cobra area, they come to us and we meet with them. They also meet with the most immediately impacted residents. We talk about the project. We talk about the possible impact on the community and quality of life matters. And if there are any things that we find very concerning, we talk about them and we make suggestions as to, you know, what they might think. You know, a recent example is we were working on a project with a developer. They had a beautiful building that they wanted to build with a blue roof. And we made some suggestions that to be more in keeping with the area, could they possibly consider, you know, more of an earth tone or muted color roof? And the developer came back in a couple of days, no problem, with a proposal for a slate gray roof. So, you know, that's a much more simplified example, but it just demonstrates how we're able to work with developers easily, no problems, brainstorm ideas, and come up with things that, you know, our community can be excited about.
And that's kind of what you expect it's supposed to be. A developer comes in, and obviously they have to get permits. And there's a law they have to follow. There are rules and regulations they have to follow. But they also probably would like to, you know, be good stewards of the land and also good neighbors, talking to groups like yours so that there's no, you know, fighting going on between the sides. Are you concerned that with this group of developers doing this, basically doing what they want, ignoring the stop work orders, this could be setting a dangerous precedent?
This is very highly concerning on several levels. First of all, an environmental level. This work was done without permits. Environmental studies have not been done. And so we really don't know the true environmental impact of the excavation. That's first and foremost for the overall environment. You know, second of all, for the Ag Reserve, this is a very special area. Everybody in the Ag Reserve cares a great deal about it. And we want to make sure that whatever's done in the Ag Reserve is the right thing. And so to have somebody just come in and do something in the manner in which they have done it is very worrisome.
Yeah. And something, then, by the way, yeah. Just I want to get to this. So two other things have been going on, you know, on this construction site. There is a building that's going up, and I want to ask about that. But there was also a wall. They built a wall?
I do know that they built some berms. And they built like a wall of palm trees. So they did make efforts to shield it from the road. So it would be very difficult to see. For example, on 441, they put up a big berm. But yes, they also put a structure on the property, again, without permits. And I did happen to see the structure. Valencia Reserve was kind enough to allow me on the property so I could see this building being put up.
And what is it?
It's some sort of like a gigantic storage shed of sorts. You know, maybe that you would store equipment or something. It's just like a very rough, gigantic storage shed.
Yeah. So what's next? I mean, what has the county said about what they're going to do? It just sounds like this group of developers are just going to go ahead and do whatever they want, and they're going to finish it.
It does seem that, and that's really concerning when you think about all the other developers that have done projects in the Ag Reserve that followed the rules, collaborated with Cobra, worked with the county, and really went out of their way, assuming expense on their part of the developer to make sure that everything was in compliance. So it's really terrible just to have this happening.
Yeah.
The next deadline is January 19th. The owners of the property have until January 19th to get the property into compliance. And then if they do not, on January 21st, there's a magistrate hearing.
Okay. All right. Well, it's a story we're going to keep following. Obviously, a lot of implications here when you talk about, you know, developing in South Florida. And again, I just invite anybody who lives in that area, you want to share your story of what you've seen, you can always email us, sundial@wlrnnews.org. Again, we will talk with county officials at some point, and we did invite the developers. The invite is always there. We'd love to hear their side of the story. Beth Rappaport, again, president of Cobra. Beth, thank you so much for the insight.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Thanks for having me, and thank you for drawing attention to this very serious issue that we're dealing with here.
Absolutely. And again, we will continue to follow this story. Well, that is our program for this Thursday, January 14th. Sundial Senior Producers Chris Remington, Leslie Ovalle is our producer and social media editor. Our engagement editor is Katie Lepre. Our news director is Terrence Shepard. Alicia Zuckerman is our editorial director. WLRN's program director is Jason Zabka, and our technical supervisor is Peter J. Meritz. And by the way, the theme music for the show from the Miami Afro-Cuban funk band Palo at gopalo.com. All right, coming up next week on the program, we'll have a Martin Luther King Day special coming up on Monday. The new film, One Night in Miami, is out now. It tells the story of the historic Hampton House and the many civil rights legends that stayed there over the years, including Martin Luther King, Malcolm X, Muhammad Ali. You'll hear our conversation with Dr. Eden Pinckney and the actors from a theatrical production of that story. Plus, this month for the Sundial Book Club, we're reading The Orchid Thief by Susan Orlean. Hope you're enjoying the book, the phenomenal true story of the orchid hunting in South Florida, and the characters, the colorful characters that take part in it. Hope you're enjoying that read. Find us on Facebook, Sundial Book Club. That and more coming up next week on the show. We will have special coverage of President-elect Joe Biden's inauguration next Wednesday, beginning at noon. I'm Luis Hernandez. Have a wonderful Friday, a great weekend. Stay safe. We'll talk to you live next week.